Hey everyone, welcome back. So in case you're new here, we're IncludeCS, a podcast aiming to make computer science more accessible and enjoyable for everyone.
We're also trying to increase participation in the computer science field by getting more people interested in computer science through telling stories about current events, news, and connecting them back to the work that a lot of professors at UC Davis do. I'm Janelle Salonga, a science and tech studies major minoring in community development here at UC Davis.
And I'm Joel Porque, a huge podcast fan and an assistant professor of teaching computer science here at UC Davis.
Well, I know it seems like a million years ago, but before COVID-19 was everywhere, it was election season in the US.
Super Tuesday was actually a couple of days ago when we started writing this script.
Given what happened in the Iowa caucus, the widespread use of voting machines, and the fast approaching 2020 presidential election, we thought election tech would be the perfect topic for this quarter's episode.
And we know what you're thinking. What is election tech? Election technology? How does it work? Is it safe? I thought you could only vote on paper. These are questions we're trying to answer in this episode.
Election tech is the assistive tech that counts your vote and gives you instant results the night of the election. And so this technology is usually used to bring people the results faster. Because I mean, if you have people counting ballots for, say, a million people, that's going to take a long time.
And actually counting votes, it's been an issue that people have worked to achieve starting as early as the 1890s with something called a mechanical lever machine. Voters would pull on the lever and increment the counter associated with the candidate by one. These were actually the dominant form of election technology for nearly 100 years until the rise of the punch card in the 1980s. They were discontinued mostly because they were old and more expensive than the new punch card.
So with punch cards, the voter would make a hole in the ballot, discarding the chad, and then the votes would be counted using a card reader. And so these are no longer used in federal elections because of what happened with Bush and Gore in the 2000 election.
The Bush-Gore fiasco was caused because some of the punch cards had partially attached chads, and those chads were not completely discarded properly from the punch card itself. The counting machine would read the ballots incorrectly. And so following this election, there was a huge push for electronic voting itself, not just like a punch card being read by a reader, because it was assumed that there would be no ambiguity or mistakes with electronic voting where users would just have to push a button. Author with thought.
Now, the majority of electronic voting is done on something called a direct recording electronic machine, or DREs. A voter would cast their ballot using a touchscreen or a button on one of these machines. And so before casting their vote, the machine would print out a piece of paper, which allows the voter to verify their vote and create a paper trail for a potential audit.
Around 15% of people cast paper ballots because of voting by mail or paper ballots in person on election days. However, technology is still involved because those ballots are counted via a scanning machine. Similar to a Scantron machine, the machine reads in a paper ballot and counts the vote electronically.
I've only voted in two elections. I voted in the 2018 midterms because I was still 17 when the 2016 presidential election happened, and I voted in the 2020 primary that happened in March. So I voted by provisional voting the first time I voted in the midterm, and that was through a direct recording electronic machine because I had to vote via touchscreen, and then I got like a little paper that said like, okay, so this is verifying your vote, keep this in case of an audit or anything like that. This year, when I voted in the primary, I decided to vote via mail because I'm a college student and I didn't want to wait in line for many hours, which is a common thing that happens, at least in the US, when it comes to voting. Like, for example, this year, there was a polling station set up in the Memorial Union at Davis. Apparently, there was a very, very long line of students who were waiting there for hours because there were both options for provisional voting for students who hadn't registered to vote but were eligible, and then for already registered voters. So the process took a long time. That's why a lot of people, including me, voted by mail. And that process is really simple because you just fill out your paper ballot, send it in the mail, and you don't have to worry about it unless they send you a message saying that, like, for example, your signature isn't what we have on file, which happened to my partner.
That sounds rough.
Yeah, it was. It's really weird because I feel like his signature didn't change at all. But yeah. Has anything similar happened to you in France? Like, are you an American citizen, Joel?
I am not an American citizen. I'm not sure I can become an American citizen with such a strong accent.
I don't know if they, I don't think they police you on their on your accent.
No, voting in France is quite different. I guess it's explained by the numbers, you know, like I looked it up online, and in France we have about 50 million registered voters, and they are the same kind of issues in the US as in France in terms of, you know, the rate of abstention. For the last presidential election, for example, we had a total of 35 million ballots. To compare that with the US, in the last presidential election in November 2016, there were about 140 million ballots in the US. So it's a lot more, right? So I think there's less of an issue of needing to count many, many ballots very fast. Oh. And so for the most part, we are still using paper ballots. So you go to the voting station, you pick pieces of paper, you go into kind of a little room by yourself, you put the piece of paper in an envelope, and then you go to a desk where people are, like election volunteers. You have to show a piece of ID. They search your name to find you in the electoral list. Then it's actually funny because the person who looks at your ID tries to find you in the listing. And when they find you, they yell out your name in the entire station, like, Joel Parquet, like, born that date in this city, is allowed to vote, something like that.
Oh, and my God, like, really?
Yeah, because the whole thing has to be public and transparent. So once this person has yelled that you are allowed to vote because you are in the listing, then you go to the voting urn, you know, so there's like this big transparent box kind of in the middle of the room, and you put your envelope, not inside yet, because like you have to put it above it. And then there's a person in charge of pushing this button that mm-hmm. will make your envelope go inside of the box. Wow. And at the same time that they push the button and that the envelope goes in, they also yelled, Joel Parquet has voted. And that's the end of it. And then I think you sign a piece of paper that says that you voted. And
well, how long did it take for that whole process?
Oh, you mean like going to vote? That's 5-10 minutes.
I thought you were gonna say it takes hours if they call out your name and stuff like that.
No, it's actually pretty fast because like most of the voting stations, maybe they have, I don't know, like 500 to 1,000 people each station. So it's actually not that many people. And the counting itself, so for a presidential election, for example, most of the voting stations would be closed by 6 p.m. and we would have some of the early results at 8. A couple of hours later, we would have a pretty good idea of who won the election.
Mm-hmm. So you being here means that you can't vote by mail.
You cannot vote by mail.
Okay.
And some cities are experimenting with electronic voting, but it is not something that's very used at all.
That makes sense, considering that there can be a lot of issues with voting technology. And to answer some of those questions and to kind of talk about some of the issues that voting technology brings up, we talked to Matthew Bishop, who's a computer science professor at Davis, researching voting technology and security.
So, let's get proper introduction. Can you please tell us your name, what you do here, your background, like everything we should know and the audience should know about you?
Yes. Name is Matt Bishop. I'm a professor here and one of the co-directors of the Computer Security Laboratory here, which is one of the oldest academic security groups. And I got into security because I was interested in privacy. But I'm a little bit unusual in that most people who do privacy do cryptography. And I use cryptography as a tool, but it's not my main area. My main area is systems.
What we call cryptography is designing secure communication protocols, allowing people or entities to talk and exchange information with one another without being spied on by third parties. That's actually why cryptography is so often associated with encryption, in the sense that encryption makes the exchanged data look like gibberish to anyone who doesn't have the key. Electronic voting machines use cryptographic techniques in order to prevent the tampering with the voting process.
So let me ask you the question, how long have you worked specifically in election technology?
I did some work on...
Bishop has conducted a lot of research in his career in security, and most of his work is focused on penetration testing. That's when a programmer practices testing a computer system to find any vulnerabilities that could be exploited. During his career, he would run mock election simulations to test the reliability of electronic voting machines.
That's what we've done on a number of occasions. We're given the voting machine, and we basically are asked, what can you do to mess this thing up so that it will give you incorrect results or crash? And at least in California, the crashing is important, because if you can crash the machine, they can't reboot it there. It has to go back to Election Central.
While some problems with electronic voting machines originate with security vulnerabilities in the software, there are tons of other potential flaws in the system. Lack of testing for programmers, differing voting standards and practices between counties and states, and vulnerabilities in the hardware itself.
You see, when people build these things, they think everyone's going to cooperate. And they don't think nasty. And that's the big problem with the voting machines. The people who built them, the initial designs, were not done with security in mind. So as a result, a lot of fairly standard attacks worked.
In one case, Professor Bishop exposed flaws in a voting machine by physically opening it up and tampering with the hardware, which is pretty gnarly.
That's badass.
With the RABA study, we did physical stuff like picking locks. One of the people there picked the lock that kept the machine secure. He picked it, I think, in about 5 seconds. Then we plugged in a keyboard, hit escape, and it came up and said, supervisor mode, what do you want to do? And at that point, we could switch votes. So things like that.
In another case, the problem with the voting machine didn't even have to do with security. It came from a lack of anticipation of errors from the programmer.
And it was really silly because on the voting machine, they have the little boxes with the candidate's name and you touch them. What she did was she touched it and then dragged her hand down. And it was in the bottom thing, and it turned out that triggered a Java exception that wasn't caught. And once they knew that, it took them about 10 seconds to fix it.
To any of my students who are listening, this is exactly why I make you guys error check and write good test cases.
Because sometimes, even when everything functions perfectly, there can still be things that go wrong. Like with DREs, machines can malfunction on election day because they're not used to handling large amounts of memory.
Oftentimes, the machines are not tested thoroughly enough. That's the problem, because you really need to test these things at scale. In Yolo County, we typically get, on a good election, maybe 30 to 40,000 people voting. In LA, you get probably several million people voting. And so if you don't test the machines at being able to handle that level of people, you have problems.
Why do we need machines, and why don't we just use regular paper ballots, which would take a couple of hours to count?
Why do we keep trying?
Two things. As far as counting ballots go, in California, because of the way the ballots are laid out, it would probably take several days to hand count them. However, the reason they went to voting machines is because of the 2000 debacle in the presidential race. What happened was a number of ballots were mismarked, in particular in Florida, which was the crucial state, pushed George Bush over the top. In order to avoid ambiguity, they went to machines. The other thing, too, is with disabled people, if you're blind, for example, the way it's usually done in the past is you would have someone read you the ballot. But that means they know how you voted. With the machines, they have audio.
So if I try to summarize everything you said, I mean, at least in terms of voting technology, it sounds like if everything is on paper and the counting is manual, it's too slow, it takes multiple days. So then the first idea was to say, okay, we're going to keep paper ballots, but we're going to have machines count the votes so that it's faster. Except that those machines were not secure enough or there were issues. And so we came up with other machines to fix the issue so that both the voting process and the counting process would now be done electronically.
The first part is correct. It would take quite a while. For whatever it's worth, ballots are counted by electronic scanner. And that software is fairly standard software. So those scanners tend not to be seen as the main problem as the machines that are put out there in contact with voters.
You think that lawmakers have the kind of appropriate technological background to be making laws about voting technology or just technology in general?
I would say that to expect them to know everything about everything is simply unrealistic. Right. But on the other hand, if you are making laws about technology, you should at least know the basics so that you know when an expert is telling you BS or when someone who's testifying is telling you something that's wrong.
So I guess that brings us to the big question, can electronic voting be secured one day?
Yeah, what would a perfect electoral system look like in terms of voting technology?
Well, the first thing is, all of what I've said is based on the requirements in the U.S., which is basically the ballot has to be anonymous, so it can't be linked to anyone, and it has to be secret, so you cannot prove how you voted. It's that second one that gets everyone. If you change the requirement, if you eliminate those, for example, then yeah, the voting technology is real easy to do. Problem is with electronic voting, there's no way to do both, or at least no way I've seen to do both. The standard technique that's discussed is cryptography, but that also assumes that all the software on the machines is incorruptible because you have to trust something. So do I think that there is voting technology? I think voting technology is an assistive device, is critical. And that needs to be there. But in general, my own impression is that given our inability to secure systems, there's no reason that voting systems would be any different. And also, what makes it worse is there are very high assurance systems out there, systems where it's very difficult for someone to change things without modifying the software. And those systems tend to be locked down very, very tightly. They're also extremely expensive, and so those technologies are not used. If you developed a voting machine using very high assurance, tied it to the requirements very concretely, then I'd be willing to listen to an argument that, yes, this technology might be worthwhile. I've not seen that yet. So my own opinion is that if you need to vote on a machine, that's one thing. If you don't need to vote on the machine, then use paper. The other thing, too, is paper can be audited a lot more easily than the machines.
At the end of the day, like, how much do you trust in the voting system?
So, again, the question is, what can you trust and who can you trust? And the goal is to minimize things, and I think putting a voting machine in there adds more layers of trust because you have to trust the software, you have to trust the hardware, you have to trust a number of other things. The configuration and so forth. Whereas on paper, you only have to trust that the pen is actually going to record it. Voting machines introduce problems, but there can be problems throughout the entire system. And so saying that if we get rid of voting machines, we're fine. No. If we get rid of voting machines, we've simply eliminated some layers of trust.
Okay, last question. Are you optimistic for the future of electronic voting?
Do I think that electronic voting will go away? I don't think it should go away because people who can't vote on paper for whatever reason need some mechanism so that they can vote privately. However, for the broad population which can use paper, I'm hoping that it will move more and more towards paper and then using machines to count the paper possibly and then doing a very effective audit.
Again, thank you to Professor Bishop for taking the time to sit down with us. That was a really in-depth and interesting interview, and I hope you all who are listening got a lot out of it, because I know we did.
It sure brings a lot of questions. It's actually almost overwhelming. I'm not going to give too many pieces of opinion, but I think my takeaway would be around three aspects. The computer science professor in me has obviously a strong opinion about the technological aspect around voting technology. It seems like in the US and actually in France too, most of the issues around voting technology is the lack of openness of that technology. Voting machines are provided by private companies who are not really willing to open any of the hardware that they're using or any of the software, thinking that by obfuscating their code and making their code private, that's going to ensure security. And most often than not, it's actually the exact opposite. If the code is closed, then it's much easier for an attacker to take advantage of a bug that might not be revealed. I think we need higher standards for the technology that is involved in the voting process. Take the example of software viruses. About 20 years ago, computers were very often being infected by viruses such as I Love You or My Doom to a rate that was absolutely crazy. For the most part, it was caused by the fact that the software contained bugs and vulnerabilities that could be exploited by attackers. Now take the example of Android phones. Android phones work mostly on open source software, such as the Linux kernel or some of the PCs that Google is using for the Android operating system, which are open source. There are, for the most part, no big viruses that are infected a lot of phones, because every time that there is a vulnerability or a bug, because the code is open source, it gets fixed very, very fast. Updates are transmitted quickly, and so devices stay, for the most part, pretty secure. I think that for this voting process, we should really encourage private companies to be open. And for that, I think there's a responsibility for the state and the government at large to make sure that the voting process, because it's such a fundamental part of democracy, we should have very, very high standards to make sure that it cannot be tampered with. Another aspect is the actual relationship between technology and voting. As a computer science professor, I'm not obviously opposed to technology. It's something that I actually teach to my students. But I think it's very important that technology should be used to solve problems, not just because it's fun and it makes things easier. In that sense, and especially for voting, because it's such a crucial process of a democracy, I don't think we should push for technological solution because it's fun or because it makes things more convenient. So for example, if technology allows voting to be more accessible, voting to be more secure, those kind of aspects, I'm all for it. If technology is just used because it's more fun to use mobile apps than actual ballot papers, then I think it's a mistake. And I think the recent debacle in the Iowa caucus shows that the DNC decided to go for an app that was developed in like a couple of months instead of just going for paper or for any kind of voting process. And on the day of, it didn't work. And it was a complete screw up. And last, I think maybe the most important is that there's a crisis right now, crisis of trust in the voting system, which worries me a lot. People who are trying to push the idea that voting should not be trusted because of supposed frauds. I think that if anything, we should be very careful that technology doesn't fuel this fire, this crisis that people don't trust the votes, that people actually do believe that the results of the vote are to be trusted. It's kind of tough.
Yeah, it is tough because I feel like technology as social media specifically is always going to compound that crisis of trust that you mentioned, because people are always going to be suspicious, but social media gives them a platform to express that suspicion and to amplify that suspicion. It can function as an echo chamber where you follow people who agree with you when they spread your message. It just branches out like a network or a tree, and more people feel that crisis of trust that you were talking about. From a more social studies standpoint, I think that accessibility is good. I think that you should be designing with the most vulnerable populations in mind. And so, as Bishop mentioned, you know, it is good to have electronic voting for people who may, you know, need electronic technology to be an assistive function. So, for example, folks who are disabled. But I feel like voting by mail is a lot more accessible for the majority of people, especially because, for example, people who are holding down multiple jobs, who don't have the time or the capacity to wait in line for multiple hours at a polling place for just, you know, a process that is relatively quick, like voting by mail is a lot more accessible for those people and a lot easier, which means that voting by mail helps a lot more people get counted. Again, like this accessibility crisis too is something that is highlighted by COVID-19. Primaries are still going on, right? And I think a really good example of this is what just happened in Wisconsin, where the governor said, okay, we're going to postpone the election from April 7th to, I believe it was June 9th. The Supreme Court overruled that and said primary elections have to take place on April 7th as specified. Of course, that puts a lot of people at a disadvantage. Like I mentioned, not everyone has the luxury of time of being able to wait in line in the first place, but then add COVID-19 health concerns onto that. If you are somebody who has, you know, an elderly parent, or you live with somebody who is immunosuppressed, or you have young children, you're not going to want to go out and vote. And so I think that points to a larger history of disenfranchisement in electoral politics in the United States and voter suppression, because when you're enforcing measures like this, where you don't offer voting by mail or later voting as something that can be offered or amended during a public health crisis, then that is reflective of, you know, suppressing the vote of folks who are essential workers, who tend to be from Black and Brown communities, who, again, have been historically shut out from the vote. To me, voting technology and this promotion of the idea that it's really good to have election technology because it's convenient, I think that points to how the United States as a country focuses on convenience as a developed country, but not necessarily, like, you know, the most vulnerable folks in the country. And it's important that people vote. Policies affect everyone in the country, and disproportionately the people who are already disadvantaged by structural racism and structural inequality. And electoral politics, voting in elections, it is not the end all be all for change. No matter who gets elected as president, there will still be advocacy and grassroots groups fighting for the future that they believe is just and right. Just because some person gets elected doesn't mean that issues are off the table. But whoever is in office and the votes that go towards putting someone in office, that is a starting point for a true structural change. You know, that facilitates movements. And that's why it's important to make sure that more people vote and that more people trust that the process isn't polluted. Again, we want to give a warm thank you to Professor Bishop for sitting down and talking with us.
And we also want to thank our scriptwriter, Olivia Tobin, and our social media coordinators, Jules Lozano and Armin Nori, for their hard work in helping us write and promote this episode and the podcast.
Listeners, let us know what you think of this episode on Twitter, Instagram, or email. See you next time in probably 10 weeks. We'll see how this quarter goes. Make sure you do your part to flatten the curve.
This is Include CS. Logging off.
Logging off.